honored guests and students, the Great Issues Program of the Associated Students of Michigan State University welcomes you to the second in a series of lectures given by extraordinary and influential people in the nation's eye. This afternoon, we are honored to have with us a man relatively new to the limelight of national politics. This summer, as leader of Georgia's loyal Democrat delegation to the Democratic Convention, he drew recognition to what may become a career that could help revolutionize the political scene. The bloom of an era in politics is exemplified by the topic, the new politics, on which he will speak. I am pleased and proud to present to you Mr. Julian Bond.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I am pleased and proud to be here, more pleased than proud. Pleased because I have been for almost 3 weeks running around the United States making speeches. Tonight I'll make another one in the big city, and tomorrow morning go home. You don't know how pleased I am. Because I've been making so many speeches at so many different places, does that work? This one works. At so many different places, I've discovered that most colleges first look upon the kinds of people who come to make speeches as a sort of speaking entertainers. That is, we don't sing or dance, but we do about the same thing, present what amounts to, in the eyes of some of the beholders as an act, receive a great deal or a very little bit of recognition for it, bow, and move on to the next stage where the act is gone through again. And because most people expect you to have an hour's act, and because I don't have an hour's act, I've been forced to pad my speech with little bits and of this and that, which I hope brings some light into what is a dark world, and incidentally, a very dark room, too. So before I begin, let me tell you some things that may make you feel a little better. First, let me give you some good news. This is something I read in I.F. Stone's Weekly. It comes from the Washington Post of October 9th, and it's good news for people who are afraid that if Richard Nixon is president, then everything will be conservative. And it's good news because it's a headline from the Washington Post, and it says, LeMay charges Nixon plans left-wing cabinet. So if you were worried that you don't have to worry about anything. You should see there are all sorts of little dials and things on the other side of this podium, and makes you feel as though you had great power. Now, here goes a joke now. There's going to be a new television show, probably sometime after the election on Tuesday. And it'd be like other television shows in that it'll have a lot of drama and blood and violence and excitement. This one will have, however, very little sex, not too much love interest, and will be based on the Democratic National Convention. And it would be on TV now, except the producers don't know what it should be called. Some of them think it ought to be called Beat the Press, and others think it ought to be called Mace the Nation. Now, now let me dispense with the frivolities, and I'm still not ready to give the speech yet. But I want to read some things to you. These are very brief and won't take up much time, but I think they're very, if not important, at least interesting. And there are two different sorts of things. First things first. The first two things I'd like to read are two poems. Now, I am, in addition to being a politician by profession, I have been a poet and have had my poems published in several anthologies in this country and in several languages, in English and French, and have had an interest in poetry and have been worried because the American people, I think, college students among them, feel almost as contemptuous of poets as they do of politicians. And when one is both a poet and a politician, like another well-known politician is in this country, you have to do all you can to overcome that feeling of contempt. So what I want to do is read two poems to you, one of them which I like a great deal, but no one else seems to, and the other which lots of people seem to like, but I don't care for it too much myself. And these are written by a young lady named Jane Stembridge. She is white and a native of Georgia. She was the first employee of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1960, and she left SNCC and came back and worked again in 64 and 65. And she wrote a collection of poems which was published privately and sold quite well in the private edition, and now a commercial publisher has bought this publication out in a regular book, and I doubt if it's available at bookstores because it hadn't been out too long, but those of you who like poetry ought to buy it if you get a chance. The name of the book is I Play Flute, and the poetess's name is Jane Stembridge. And the first poem is called The Flute. And it says, "Where in all the awful apparatus we acquired to hasten freedom is the flute, the fine thin flute, the flute thin thing, the thin thing which thinner than the rain rings freedom in." And the other one is called Mrs. Hamer and is about Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer of Ruleville, Mississippi. Now, if you will remember your television history, you will remember that at the Democratic National Convention in 1964, Mrs. Hamer and a group of people from the state of Mississippi representing the Freedom Democratic Party came to the convention and asked the Democrats to unseat the regular delegation from Mississippi and to seat Mrs. Hamer and the Freedom Democrats in their place. Well, the convention declined to do that and decided instead they would offer what the Democrats must have thought was a legitimate compromise. Instead of all the seats from the state of Mississippi, two seats at large representing nothing. And for some unfathomable reason, the Freedom Democrats rejected that compromise. And they came back to the convention in 68, and they did get all the seats on this time. But this is about the 64 convention, and it's called Mrs. Hamer. It says, "The revolutionary element remained intact. They simply stood. No, sir," she said, "we didn't come for no two seats, since all of us is tired." Now, you didn't like that one. Now, two other things, and then I'll be ready to read my speech, deliver my speech, I'm sorry. And these are two excerpts from history. You know, I've always believed the reason people make so many mistakes is that they don't know the mistakes other people have made. And that's because none of us are very good students of history. And so I want to read you two things that come, one from fairly recent history, that is within the last 50 years, and the other comes from American history a bit more in the past, about 116 years ago. And these are two excerpts, one from an article and one from a speech. Come from two different kinds of men. One is a man who is very well educated in the formal sense, attended Harvard College and Harvard University, and I think the University of Munich, who learned how to read in several different languages and who is a well-known scholar and writer and lecturer and author. And the other from a man who had no education whatsoever, or rather who was self-educated, who was born a slave, who escaped from slavery, who taught himself to read and write and became a well-known figure of his day. Now, the first one has to do with one of the two main currents that has run through the black community since the first African came to this country as a slave. Those two currents have been assimilation, or integration, and separatism. And this is from an essay defending separatism by a man who died just 5 years ago, but who wrote this piece some 30 years ago, the late Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. And he says, "We swallow our pride and beg for things. We agitate and get angry. And with all that, we face the blank fact Negroes are not wanted, neither as scholars or as businessmen, neither as clerks or as artisans, neither as artists or as writers. What can we do about it? We cannot use force. We cannot enforce law, even if we get it on the statute books, so long as overwhelming public opinion sanctions and justifies and defends color segregation. We are helpless, without remedy. We are segregated. We are cast back on ourselves. Surely then, in this period of frustration and disappointment, we must turn from negation to affirmation, from the everlasting no to the everlasting yes. Instead of sitting sapped of all initiative and independence, instead of drowning our originality in imitation of mediocre white people, instead of being afraid of ourselves and seeking to cultivate the art of skulking to escape the color line, we have got to renounce a program that always involves humiliating, self-stultifying scrambling to crawl somewhere we are not wanted, where we crouch panting like a whipped dog. We have got to stop this and learn that on such a program we cannot build manhood. No, by God, we had rather stand erect in a mud puddle and tell the white world to go to hell rather than lick boots in a parlor. Affirm, as we have a right to affirm, that the Negro race is one of the great human races, inferior to none in its accomplishment and its ability. Different, it is true, and for most of the difference, let us reverently thank God. This race, with its vantage grounds in modern days, can go forward of its own will, of its own power, of its own initiative. It is led by millions of American Negroes of average modern intelligence. Millions of African Negroes are their equals. Millions of Negroes in the West Indies and South America. This body of millions of modern men is not called upon to commit suicide because somebody doesn't like their complexion or their hair. And the other one, as I say, comes from further away in history and happened on the occasion of a celebration of the 4th of July in 1852. And it happened that present at the celebration was a well-known orator and newspaper editor and writer named Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass was a very famous man of his day, and someone apparently saw him in the crowd and said, "Oh, Mr. Douglass, won't you come here and get on the speaker's platform and tell us how grateful you are to be living in the United States in 1852, how pleased your people are to be able to celebrate Independence Day, and how terrifically happy all of you are that you live in the land of the brave and the home of the free." Well, Douglass must have been irritated at having someone interrupt his barbecue, I guess. It was 4th of July. And so this is what he said. He said, "What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all the other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty and unholy license, your national greatness is swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy." Oh, talk it, Fred. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may. Wait a minute. I'm not through. "Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. That goes to show, I think, several things. First, that people who spoke and wrote 100 years ago spoke and wrote much better than people speak and write today. And secondly, that the kinds of discussions that go on today are not discussions that are being discussed for the first time. But I don't intend to dwell on 1852, but rather on 1968 and the kind of odd year it has been. It's been odd for several reasons. First, because we have seen a great deal less of the kinds of violence in the streets than we had imagined we would, at least from black people. Saw a great deal more student activism on college campuses with a promise of a great deal more to come. Saw a greater rise in black consciousness among young and old black people. And we saw, through the summer of 1968, American college students becoming more and more of a political force. Politically, this has been a very strange year. A handful of young people, some of them gathered in the snow in New Hampshire, and others gathered around the Pentagon in Washington, have made the most powerful political leader on the face of the earth voluntarily retire. For the first time in a long time in 1968, the national liberal community had two possible presidential candidates to work for and to argue about. One of these two possible candidates was denied his chance at the nomination by assassination, the other by democracy. Now we come down to the wire, or election day rather, in most parts of the country faced with a choice, as George Wallace likes to say, between Tweedledum and Tweedledee, with ex-Governor Wallace being not what you say he is, but Tweedledum-dum. Now we are faced in this particular election, if the polls are correct, and they have been correct every year since Thomas Dewey beat Harry Truman, we are faced with the prospect of having as President of the United States a man whose entire public life has been characterized by the old politics, the politics of smear and deception, a man whose vice presidential candidate slanders white and non-white minorities. Then we have another candidate among the Trinity offered this year. He is a hillbilly Hitler whose running mate is a trigger-happy tin soldier. They offer something frightful on the American political scene, something that Americans have not had offered to them since Richard Nixon's advisor, Strom Thurmond, was a presidential candidate in 1948, and that is a chance for racism to channel its political energies into a legitimate direction. And then we have the Democrats. Two men with between them, three-quarters of a likable record, but two men tied hopelessly to policies of war that must be rejected, that have been rejected, and which will be rejected if America ever again tries to become another small country's policeman. And then we have, in 1968, problems of race that have worsened in the United States over the past 30 years. Every attempt at improving conditions for black people in this country has had the contrary result of raising expectations and making possible surface and superficial integration, but without allowing black people any opportunity to contain the forces that control our lives. What is so frustrating for black people in 1968 is that white people believe things have gotten better. White people have heard presidents say, "We shall overcome," on national television. White Americans have seen bill after bill after bill pass the Congress of the United States to completely eliminate legal segregation, while black Americans know that racism does not need the color of law to divide families, to render education for black children useless, or to make black unemployment 10 times as high as white. White Americans ask themselves, what can these people want? They can eat at lunch counters with us. They can go to movie theaters with us. They can vote where they couldn't vote before. What more can they want? The black American answers that his right to eat at a lunch counter is irrelevant to a race of people whose pocketbooks are empty. Our right to attend movie theaters is useless. Our right to vote is just as useless if we are continually faced with a choice on election day between a James O. Eastland and a John C. Stennis, or a Strom Thurmond or a George or a Lurleen Wallace or the other three that are running now. And when white people assume that everything is all right, we black people must answer that nothing is right with us. We are more out of work in 1968 than ever before. We are living in conditions more crowded in 1968 than ever before. We are attending more segregated schools in 1968 than ever before. We are making less money in 1968 than ever before. And our children are dying faster in the first year of their lives than they ever did before. So while white America agonizes with one problem or another, black people know that our problems have always been the same. The problem of existing in a society directed and dominated by racism. A society that demands some people accept poverty in order for others to be rich. A society that starts wars to reinforce its position as dominator of the world. Our problem then, the problem of being black in a white world, the problem of belonging to a non-white majority in a world dominated by a fading white minority, is coupled to all of the other American problems of the 20th century. The war in Vietnam, as an example, is certainly not our particular problem. We did not declare the war. Well, no one else has either. But we do not escalate it, but we fight in it, we suffer in it, we die in it in greater proportions than do any other group of Americans. We suffer to live in America's massive cities, in slums we did not create. We breathe in air polluted by factories we do not own. We do not determine what the policy of America toward the third world shall be, but we suffer when America condemns Biafran children to die, or when she mounts invasion against legitimate revolution, or when she pits her military might against black or brown people who want to be free. We cannot determine what America's policy toward Russia or China shall be, but we know we will suffer and die when and if American intervention and overreaction begin World War III. Being therefore powerless in a powerful society, black in a society that is white, poor in a society run by and for rich people, we must seek in 1968 and 1969 and 1970 and 1972, as never before, the means and ways to make the American dream stop being our special nightmare. We must seek the ways and the means to build movements that, through either reform or revolution, will change racism and war into compassion and peace. We cannot do this, unfortunately, by our own initiative. We are too small a group in this nation. We have neither the numbers or the wealth or the power to by ourselves make the push that must be made. Now we know that increased militance from us is likely to bring on the concentration camps, as it did for Jews in Germany and without any militancy at all for Japanese in this country. Just as white America's young people have discovered that police riots, like that in Chicago, will follow increased agitation, black people have discovered that America's police force prepared with hopeful anticipation for a long, hot summer in 1968, that to their disappointment did not come. This does not mean, however, that those black or white young people who would enter militant politics or who would take the struggle into the streets ought not do so. It does not mean that militancy ought to be suppressed for fear of an escalating backlash. A great black man from whom I read something before, Frederick Douglass, was once asked to define what the nature of the struggle ought to be. And this is what he said. He said, "Let me give you some words on the philosophy of reform. The whole history of the progress of human liberty shows that all concessions yet made to her earnest struggles have been born, to her august claims, have been born of earnest struggle. The conflict has been exciting, agitating, all-absorbing, and for the time being, putting all other tumults to silence. It must do this or do nothing. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its mighty waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and never will. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you have found out the exact measure of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them, and these will continue till they are resisted with either words or blows or both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppressed." What was true for Frederick Douglass 100 years ago is true for us today. Power still concedes nothing without a demand. Agitation is still required if there is to be progress. Tyrants will rule till the oppressed reach the limit of their endurance. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. That message from more than 100 years ago places a special kind of burden on the kinds of people Frederick Douglass called liberty-loving people. That burden is to continue struggle, to continue agitation, to continue organizing the new coalition that will bring about the kind of new tomorrow that rings so loudly in the liberal rhetoric of today. That new coalition must replace the old coalition, the coalition of labor, of black people, of liberals, that the Democratic Party and George Wallace have destroyed. The Democratic Party has destroyed it by driving out the liberal left. George Wallace has destroyed it by co-opting the millions of members of trade unions. The trade union movement itself has destroyed it by fighting to keep black and brown Americans out of unions, by fighting at the Democratic Convention in favor of more war and against the Southern Challenge delegations. That old coalition of trade unions, of big city plantation bosses like Richard Daley and the Southern Dixiecrats, that old coalition won a victory in Chicago. In winning, they began the death of their movement. In winning, they beat and clubbed on the streets of Chicago the only people in Chicago who were interested in small d democratic politics. The new coalition has yet to be formed, and quite probably yet to be defined. It should and will, of course, include black people in massive numbers. It should additionally include poor white people, the new middle class, the youth, and Spanish-speaking brown Americans. This new coalition will become possible for black and white alike only if it is honest in meeting the needs of black people and does not use us for our votes alone. Only if it addresses itself to the problems of black and white workless people and offers them either jobs or income now. Only if it demands and gets an end to American imperialism, demands and gets an end to gunboat diplomacy, demands and gets an end to America becoming a force against revolution and a force in favor of fascism across the world. Finally, this new coalition will never exist unless America's young people, black and white, leave their campuses, come into the streets, begin to organize the black and white poor, begin to radicalize the middle class, begin to replace slogans and rhetoric with programs and plans. If the force and energy of those young people can be turned on in the streets or up against the walls, then coalitions have a chance. Then progress and agitation and struggle and meaningful reform and quite possibly meaningful revolution have a chance. If these things do not come to pass, then we will hear another echo of guess who? Frederick Douglass, who declared in 1852, "It is not the light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be denounced. The choice is ultimately white Americans, a choice between light or fire, a choice between showers or thunder, a choice between a new slavery or freedom, a choice between continued aggressive war or peace, a choice between a world safe for democracy or a democracy made safe for the world. Black people in the cities, college students on the campuses, Spanish Americans, must be answered today. The answer they have been receiving is no. No to good jobs, no to good houses, no to a good education, no to an end to war, no to student participation in university affairs. No will not continue to be a good answer for tomorrow, however. If the answer continues to be no, then we shall find a tomorrow, like the words of the old song that says, God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time. Thank you very much.